This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Malta, an island in the Mediterranean, south of Sicily. That had been the extent of what I could tell you about Malta. I was like Rocco Raven, one of the key characters of Nicholas Rinaldi's new novel, The Jukebox Queen of Malta. Rocco is an American soldier from Brooklyn who arrives on Malta in 1942. The island controlled by the British is under siege by the Germans and the Italians. The bombing, relentless. This from the book's first chapter. When Rocco was told he was being sent to Malta, he recognized the name Malta, but had only the fuzziest notion where it was, somewhere out there, far off north or south, in a hazy distance, as dark and as mysterious as the name itself, which he repeated over and over, hearing the strangeness, almost tasting it. Malta, Malta, Malta. From the opening of Nicholas Rinaldi's latest book, The Jukebox Queen of Malta, a novel. Rocco finds Malta difficult to get hold of, difficult to grasp, like being enveloped in clouds or smoke or the lace made on the island. But then there is Melita Azard, the queen of jukeboxes. Rocco falls in love with her, a beautiful woman who drives around the island in a pink hearse, repairing jukeboxes. Melita and jukeboxes. Love, beauty, and familiarity in the midst of war. Nicholas Rinaldi is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We'll talk with him about the novel and ask him to read from it as well. Your phone calls are welcome. Join the conversation with your questions and comments. In Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free. We have a toll-free number, good, anywhere you're listening, 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Nicholas Rinaldi is the author of three collections of poetry and the novel Bridge Fall Down. His latest book, The Jukebox Queen of Malta, a novel, is published by Simon & Schuster. Nicholas Rinaldi teaches literature and creative writing at Fairfield University in Connecticut. He joins us this afternoon from the studios of public radio station WSHU in Fairfield. Nicholas Rinaldi, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon to you, Celeste.
So why Malta? Why 1942 is the setting for this novel?
I know, that's always the question. A number of years ago, I was working on a short story about an elderly World War II veteran, and I asked myself the question, well, where did he serve? And into my head just popped Malta, and I now know why. Unconsciously, I must have been thinking of the Maltese Falcon, and Christopher Marlowe has that wonderful play about Malta. Malta pops up in a lot of different places literarily, and in fact, it was a popular vacation spot for quite a few British authors. I know Sir Walter Scott started what was to be his last novel, didn't quite finish it before he passed away. There, Samuel Taylor Coleridge was there, Byron was there, and I allude quite extensively to Byron in the book. So unconsciously, I was brought to Malta. When I went to do a little bit of research on it to see where my old soldier had fought, I found such a rich mine of material that I knew there was a huge story here, and I in fact abandoned the short story. I took my old soldier back in time to 1942, and he's Rocco. So we lost my old soldier and got a young one. It was a key turning point, I found out, a very key turning point in the early part of the war. If you stop and think in your mind's eye, the picture of the Mediterranean, you have Italy reaching down that long arm into towards the center. You have Sicily, and Malta is just 60 miles south of Sicily. And then a few hundred miles south, we have North Africa, where German forces and Italian forces are adventuring, and Rommel is having enormous success in 1942. All of his supplies have to pass, his supply ships have to pass Malta, so they're vulnerable to attack from Malta, which is at the time a British possession. that's what was happening. The solution for Rommel was bomb Malta or invade Malta. They had plans to invade. They didn't do it. Mm-hmm. They didn't do it. The bombing seemed effective, but as Rommel himself noted in his journals and letters, Malta really defeated him. They were deceived into thinking that they had suppressed Malta, but in the last analysis, Malta was striking back. It held on and eventually caused Rommel's defeat in North Africa.
Yeah. Like a boxer in the ring that just won't go down.
Oh, yes, yes. And there's all these things. We have all these old newspaper items, even in America, with all these Malta stories and the political cartoons about Malta saving the world, things like that. This is in 42, long before D-Day and so on. And at a time in the war when America didn't really know quite what was happening. We just got hit by Pearl Harbor in 41, so we just got into that war. Malta was being bombed from June of 1940, so this has been going on a long, long time. And when you think of the size of that island, it's a tad bigger than Manhattan Island. It is at its length, its greatest length, it's 17 miles long. At its greatest width, it's about 5 or 6 miles, and about 7 or 8 miles wide. It's only a total of 95 square miles. And you think of 2.5 years of bombs falling on that area. It's mm-hmm. quite an astonishing image.
Yeah. When you began writing this story, were Sarajevo and the Balkans playing in the background?
Absolutely. That was certainly there. I play with that theme a little bit with this character, Nardu Kamilari, who's an old man. At the start of the novel, Rocco is billeted in a brothel because these places are much different from what we would be familiar with here, if we are familiar with it. There are three prostitutes living downstairs and working there. But on the second floor is the owner of the brothel and his family. You know, this is all sort of like a family operation. And the wife's father is the doorkeeper at the brothel, and Rocco and another soldier are billeted upstairs at the very top floor. Rocco's there only 3 days. The place blows up. But I have a fun conversation where poor Rocco hasn't slept with all the flying that he's done in those days. Flying across the ocean took a very long time, lots of stops and so on. And Nardu has this very fanciful idea that Malta is going to come out of this war as the dominant power in the Mediterranean. And he uses a lot of the language that we heard recently. He talks, you know, he talks about a greater Malta. and he foresees that. And he's got some background for this, that what he's propped up by is the memory that back in the 16th century, the Knights of Malta had defended Malta against the invading Turks. The Turks actually landed on Malta, and there was a very difficult time. The Knights were severely outnumbered. But they held, and the Maltese people held with them, and they stopped the advance of the Turks. The Turks were moving westward across the Mediterranean. Certainly, if Malta had failed to stop the Turks, Sicily would have stopped them. But Malta is the place where they were stopped. So this is a source of great pride in Maltese history. And Nardu sees this happening now, that Malta, by holding out in World War II, is stopping the Nazi aggression and the fascist aggression. But he sees the outcome as being that Malta will finally rule the entire Mediterranean. And here's the setting. I'll read a bit here. They were in the dining room in Hannibal's apartment. Hannibal is the owner of the brothel. At a table covered by a checkered oilcloth, it was shortly after noon. Beatrice, the wife, was in the kitchen preparing a stew, and Simone, one of the prostitutes, with cold cream on her face and a blue towel around her head, was eating a sandwich, watching the card game between the other prostitutes with undisguised boredom. The old man, Nardou Camilleri, sat at the head of the table. For a long time he said nothing, simply sat there, lost in thought. Then, with a fiery glance, he launched into a rambling monologue about the future of Malta. He was small and withered, but his voice, though raspy, was full of passionate conviction. He envisioned, after the war, a Malta that would emerge as the major power in the Mediterranean. A new Malta, he said, thumping the table with his thumb. After the bombing, a phoenix from the ashes. He paused to clear his throat. Then he went on forcefully, "Mark my words, as soon as the war is over, we declare our independence and we throw out the English. Then we annex Italy. Sicily, we don't want. It's too full of thugs and mafiosi. Rome, we give to the Pope. But the rest of Italy is ours. We will call it Greater Malta." Rocco liked him. The bony dome of his head, the intensity of his gaze, and the sureness in his tone, as if every word were a religious affirmation. He was balmy and old and wonderfully gnarled, his skin coarse and rugged like the bark of a tree. His feet, as he sat there at the table, had roots growing into the floor. Shame them again. The Greeks and the Egyptians will send ambassadors. Tunis and Tripoli will be on their knees. He glared truculently. You think this will not come to pass? Even the French will show respect. The whole world will honor us because, if it weren't for us, all of Africa would belong to Hitler and Europe too. We saved Europe once from the Turks 4 centuries ago, and now we are saving it again from the fascists. Without Malta, Europe would be a garbage pit. He gestured vigorously with his small hands, as if addressing a lecture hall, his dry voice rising and sifting with a wistful urgency. It was, for Rocco, a dizzying notion. Tiny Malta, a world power? He dropped a card and didn't bother to pick it up. "Our houses are bombed," Nardou Camilleri acknowledged, rocking his head from side to side, "and our airfields are pummeled. But the more we lose, the closer we are to winning. Victory is around the corner. I can taste it. It's within our grasp. Any day now, the bombers will start falling out of the sky. We will not even have to shoot them down. They will fall from sheer exhaustion out of their own dead weight. Europe is in the palm of our hands." And he goes on, and the fanciful thing about Nardou is his vision is that, you know, Malta is very famous, has always been famous for the lace mm-hmm. that the women make. And his vision is that the new economy is going to be based on this lace that the women make. And that's a theme that runs much through the book.
Yeah. Nardou is a wonderful, wonderful character. I think that if I was able to meet anyone in the novel face to face.
He's the one you like?
Yeah, he's the one I'd want to spend the day with.
I enjoyed him. I liked him. He's feisty. He's old.
He's like Malta itself.
Yes, and he refuses to die. Mm-hmm. Right. He goes when towards the end of the novel when he's in hospital. There's that long sequence where they're waiting for him to die. They need the beds. This is an old man. He should have been dead long ago by all the signs, and he just won't go. He hangs on, and he keeps coming back.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Rocco and his sort of almost, in a sense, his free fall into Malta.
Right.
Give us some idea of the confusion and topsy-turviness he experiences upon landing. You know, he's billeted for a brief period of time there in the brothel.
Right.
But also there are, the place is crazy and up for grabs as soon as he falls in.
Right. Yes, he's an American, of course. He's mm-hmm. from Brooklyn. His name is Rev, his real name is Ravenelli, but his grandfather had shortened that to Raven, thinking it would be easier to get a job in America. Of course, it wasn't for him. The Raven, of course, brings on all those Edgar Allan Poe associations that run through the book. So this is kind of a Poe-esque, gothic experience, which I thought was just the right metaphor for what was going on. He's sent there by mistake. There is a small American liaison group in place, and their radio man has gone AWOL. He's just got on a boat and vanished. So they need a new radio man. Somebody else was expected in. And somehow, a typical army snafu, Rocco's name is picked out and he's shipped over. So he's arriving rather dizzy, surprised, amazed, and lands in the midst of an air raid. Is very nearly killed himself and is just dragged to safety by the person who is now his commanding officer, Jack Fingerly, who is just a lieutenant at the time. The original commanding officer, a major, had just been killed a few days earlier. Rocco is brought to this brothel, and then 3 days later, he's trying to catch up on some sleep in the afternoon. The place is bombed. And as far as he knows, everybody that he knows, he believes to be dead. They aren't, of course. They'll all return. But he's sifting through the wreckage, then he spends a rather wild night in blackout downtown, bombed-out Valletta, on Straight Street, which is a street full of bars and brothels, ends up in a shelter, in an air raid shelter, mm-hmm. where he spends 3 days, 3 nights. And then in desperation, after a very nightmarish time, he emerges. And he emerges in the midst of an air raid. Understand the bombers are going for the docks and for the airfields, but in the days where there's no pinpoint bombing, bombs tend to fall anywhere. And it's a small island. So this is not a thing without risk that he's doing coming out of the shelter. And he climbs over a lot of rubbish. Malta, by the way, is built up with limestone blocks. They don't have a forest. They don't have wood. So the houses, buildings are all these sort of like our cinder blocks, but a little bit bigger, and they're solid limestone mined, quarried on the island. So when the bomb hits, it sort of looks like children's blocks all over the place, but very big and hard. Mm. And he's climbing over these.
There's so much that is, it's surreal, yet at the same time, you know, it's really, really like
real,
that.
Yes, terribly real. there's a moment. Would you like? There's a moment when he's walking along here,
when he
sees Melita mm-hmm. for the very first time. This is just a short passage here. He turns off Straight Street onto Nicholas, then up along Old Bakery, littered with blocks of limestone from the collapsed buildings. The air stank with the powder-burned smell of spent explosive. He climbed up a hill of rubble and went down the other side. For some distance, the street was clear, and he moved along briskly. Bombs slammed into the dockyards across the harbor, and the pom-pom guns sent up their fierce barrage. Ahead, he faced more wreckage and another high mound to cross. He thought of turning back and cutting over to Kingsway, but continued on, making his way up over the rubble. And then, as he came down on the other side, he saw, up ahead, a girl walking, casual, giving no attention to the raid, making her way, like himself, through the clogged, debris-laden street. There was a freedom in the way she moved, a confidence and self-assurance. She paused to look up as yet another Stuka swept by, this one trailing a plume of black smoke from its fuselage. Then she looked back over her shoulder and saw him coming along half a block behind her. She lingered, gazing steadily, then turned and continued on, her long black hair clasped by a silver barrette, falling loose and wanton over her shoulders all the way down to her waist. Her skirt flowed lazily, folding over her calves and thighs. It made his blood jump. He supposed that she, too, had come up out of some dark hole, craving sunlight, wanting to move and be alive, and he slowed his gait, not wanting to catch up too soon. The air shook with the roar of the anti-aircraft barrage, but he no longer heard it. It was background, out of focus, an untuned annoyance at the margin of his senses.
Nicholas Rinaldi reading from his new book, The Jukebox Queen of Malta, a novel. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You know, the scene that opens that chapter that you read from, the shelter.
Yes.
People are leaving their homes, not in panic, but in quiet haste.
Yes.
How long do you suppose it takes to go from running for a bomb shelter in panic to making your way there in quiet haste? What happens to people?
Well, the amazing thing that I found out reading, just reading the news, but the main newspaper was the Times of Malta. It was British published, so it's in English. Life amazingly went on under all this terror. People were buying and selling things, you know, 'cause nothing was coming in. There was nothing new, so the only buying and selling was just between the people. Want ads, roller skates. People are buying and selling roller skates. I couldn't believe this. Cameras. People want cameras. Victrolas. How they might have gotten the records. Well, you know, the old records, and even those were sought. Soldiers were advertising for dance lessons. I guess this was a way to meet girls. Maltese girls were very, very protected. Melita is in an unusual situation because her parents are dead, so she's sort of on the loose out there. But the typical Maltese girl would be very protected. The soldiers complained that it's hard to get any dates. So they advertised, we want dance lessons. This is the amazing thing, how life, they went to movies. There were quite a number of movie houses. In 1942, it was pretty hard to get any of the latest movies in, so they were largely playing late 1930s movies that happened to be around. Now and then, a movie would be flown in by a bomber passing through from Gibraltar on its way to Alexandria or on its way to Cairo. And you see the amazing thing, the advertisements for the movies, rock shelter on premises, you know, a guarantee that if the sirens go, we could all get underground quickly enough. It didn't always happen that way. There was more than one movie house was bombed, a few with very, very severe casualties. Hospitals were hit. The other amazing thing is this, that the neighboring island is less than half the size of the island of Malta, Gozo. They're a group. The whole group is called Malta as a nation. There is Malta proper, which is what we're talking about. And then there's this neighboring island, half its size, which is all farmland, basically. It has today even just one major town and some smaller little places, but mostly farmland. The Germans did not bomb Gozo. And at the very outset of the war, quite a few, you know, before it got too hot and too bad and too dangerous to make the crossing, quite a few people from Malta, several thousand, went over to Gozo. Interesting statistic. Population in the mental wards on Malta declined during the war. On Gozo, they increased. This is interesting. Apparently, when you're under attack, realism breaks in such a way that mental illness declines. This is much talked about by the historians because it's a very nice small situation there. You've got Malta, Gozo. It's a nice test case. Very interesting.
Yeah. We've got a caller waiting to talk with us, so let's find out what they would like to talk with us about today.
Sure.
And then we'll come back to this idea of dance lessons and roller skates. Mm-hmm. Our caller this afternoon, our first caller, is on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Rinaldi. It's Renee Thomas. Do you remember me?
Renee, yes. My goodness. How lovely. Yes.
I'm here in Champaign, and I heard you on the radio, so I had
Wonderful.
To call in.
Wonderful. Renee studied with me many years ago. She's very, very, very bright. Yes, Renee.
Well, it wasn't many years ago. It was only 2 years ago. But I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that when you were doing your other story, you started to research Malta. So when you began to shape, actually that's my question. How did you begin to shape this story? I mean, did it come sort of out of the research, or did you have some idea of how it was going to be shaped as you were doing the research or beforehand?
Renee, the very first idea that I had was, for the novel, was that passage I just read when Rocco comes up out of that shelter and he's walking along and sees Melita. That was the driving image that set me off. Then everything else was figure out how do you get there, what's he doing there, and how does this move along and how does it end, and huge amounts of research to going along simultaneously with this to figure out answers to all those questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome, 333-9455. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, you can call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Well, back to this idea of surviving while bombs are falling around you. This is where the jukeboxes come in. Tell us about the importance of jukeboxes in the story.
Jukeboxes, yeah. Well, I hypothesized that since nothing was getting in, all there, just as Malta was bombing Rommel's supply ships, Rommel's people were bombing Malta's supply ships. So if we're on starvation diet in 1942, an incredibly small amount of food available. Obviously, nothing else was getting in. I thought, jukeboxes, of course, they're not coming in. The jukebox becomes a very major symbol in the book. It's the counterpoint to the war. It's what's in a jukebox is love songs, so the jukebox is love. The box is identified with Melita. She's delivering them, so the jukebox is Melita as well.
And even though she's driving this pink hearse and delivering these things around.
Yes.
I don't know. There's life and death right there in the color and in the type of automobile.
That's right. Yeah.
In charge of.
There is a love scene where Rocco and Melita has just delivered a jukebox with Rocco to a bar. And they're on their way back.
Would you like to read that?
Yes,
for
I
us?
Would. I'm just noting that. Let me start with just the box that they've delivered first. What happens is that I'm sure most readers are not aware, but it's developed in the course of the book. The jukeboxes, as we know them, didn't come to exist until around 1938. That's the year that Wurlitzer figured out how to use all those thermoplastic rosins, plastics, to create this wonderful thing. Before that, jukeboxes were old pieces of furniture, very undeveloped kind of thing. And that's the problem that we have now, is how do you create a jukebox if you don't have all that plastic? Plastic is used for the war effort. So Melita's cousin, Zomit, he's the one, the repairman, carpenter, who has a passion for jukeboxes and initiates this thing. And he's the one building them. Melita helps him. Melita comes up with the idea of using stained glass for the jukeboxes, because the churches are bombed, all the salvage is thrown into dumps, and what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
It was Melita who came up with the idea of using stained glass. Zomit, her cousin, quite old man, was skeptical. "Why not?" she said. "Try it." He tried it, and it worked. Not only did it work, but it liberated him, freeing him from the dead formalities of the old designs and affording possibilities that even plastic didn't hold. He made oversized, muscular jukeboxes, vivid with colored glass. Some of these were as much as 7 feet tall. Others were short, squat, and very wide. He made them full-bodied and odd-angled in bizarre geometrical shapes, and always Melita was there, urging him on. "Make it bigger. Make it wider. Make it crazier and livelier with more glass. Make it glow. Make it shine. Make it so that it's a music all its own, and you don't even have to turn on the record to hear the song." And she with Rocco have just delivered a jukebox to a bar, and now they're going home. She turned off the main road and headed east toward the sea. On a narrow dirt trail, a cloud of yellowish-red dust swirling behind them. "There's a cove I want you to see, a pretty spot by the water." "I thought you were in a hurry to get back," Rocco says. "I am. There's too much to do, but it can wait." They passed terraced farms and fields purple with clover, a few palm trees. The rough, bumpy trail brought them to a spot where there was a massive growth of big-lobed cactus. She slowed, taking the car around, and what spread out before them, on the far side of the cactus, was a gentle curve of land rock-strewn and the glistening sea. "You like it?" she said. He liked it, the low, insistent waves lapping against the shore. "Are you glad I brought you here?" He was glad. "Make love to me," she said. It surprised him. "Here? Now?" She leaned into him, her lips on his, and he felt her softness. Then, playful, she broke away and climbed into the back of the hearse, and he followed. There was a blanket to lie on. It had been under the jukebox. "Love is better in strange places," she said. She pressed close to him again, quick and urgent, wanting him, and he followed her lead, turning where she turned, moving as she moved. He wondered how many coffins had been there in that space. Coffins of oak, pine, maple, coffins of copper and steel. How many had made the trip in this hearse, this box on wheels? Were they still here somehow, the dead, with their memories lingering? She closed her eyes, and as she moved beneath him, he saw the moisture gathering at her pores. And as her fingers pressed into his back, he thought that even if the planes came and bombs fell, nothing could touch her, because in her quiet, mysterious way, she wasn't even herself. She was all of the dead who were waiting to live again in the sun, and she was the flowers, too, the flowers that had gone with them, carnations and roses and heavenly honeysuckle. She turned and moaned, and then out of the long, sweet, spicy flavor, he heard her small, sudden laughter, soft and nibbling, as if, after the onslaught of her passion, she saw it now for what it was, a fit, a seizure, a mere flash of madness, and yet, despite its being only that, a simple trick of the glands, she knew it was the glittering best thing that could have happened for her that day, the best she could have hoped for or imagined. "It's such a wonderful, silly thing, making love," she said. "Are you angry it made me laugh?" He wasn't angry. He was glad. He liked the dimple at the tip of her chin, the way it deepened when she smiled. She became thoughtful, dreamy. "Do you think the dead are all around us, watching?" "The dead are really dead," he said. "Oh, no," she said. "Never think that. They are never dead. Don't you feel them? Don't you sense they are always around, looking and remembering? Don't you know how jealous they are?"
What was it like when you, from your imagination, drew out the idea for the stained glass going into the jukeboxes and the hearse as the vehicle that they would be delivered in, and that Rocco and Melita would make love there?
A lot of these things just happen as yeah. as you're working, and unless they happen, you don't have a book.
It's got to feel really wonderful
yes,
when it happens.
Yes, yeah. You wait for those moments and the sort of like bursts of energy when you see it, and you know you can work for a couple of days and get 5 or 10 or 15 pages out of that idea. It doesn't happen often, but it has to happen. Otherwise, you. At least the way I write, I would never get it out. And one waits for those things, and you can't manufacture them.
Mm-hmm.
They just arrive. Unless for me, a lot of it happens with while I'm researching. I get a lot of ideas. It wasn't as if I just researched the book and then wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
I had that first idea. Then researched, and then wrote more, and then researched, and then wrote more. And the research was feeding ideas, you know. And jukeboxes initially were, you know, what does she do? Jukeboxes, sounds nice. Then look up jukeboxes, and then find out that famous year, 1938, and all about thermoplastics, and find out a lot of things you never want to use and don't use. But all kinds of new thoughts spring into your mind as you're looking at those other items.
Yeah. The stained glass going into the jukeboxes, I think, is just wonderful. Some years ago, I heard a documentary done by German radio producers about the bells of Europe and how they were taken from churches and made into weapons, into guns. And you know, here is something coming out of a church and being joyful and prayerful in a time of war.
Yes, there's lots of things like that. The way objects get incorporated into art one way or another. I just gave a reading last week at a synagogue of all places, and they had this wonderful piece of art in a cove, and it incorporated pieces from the clothes that the Holocaust people had to wear. And this was amazing, you know, that this person, this artist, actually went out and grabbed, found somewhere these horrible things that the victims had to use. And I think artists are doing this a lot today, writers, artists, going out and grabbing onto real items, real things, real facts from history, and somehow incorporating them. That's how I felt the years I was working on this book, is that I needed that contact with reality, and then let the surrealism float up out of those facts.
It's an act of recovery.
Yes, yeah, very much so.
Is there a relationship between your work in poetry and the way you work in fiction?
I think so. I do work for the poetic moments in my writing. Like I'm not a strictly plot oriented writer. And I guess this is since the time of Chekhov, right? You know, where we've moved away from relegated plot now. Strict plot is. I love very plotted novels when I'm reading detective work or things of that sort. That's wonderful stuff. Straight adventure novels. The Chekhovian piece is moves away from that. It goes into character, it goes into image, it goes into metaphor. Metaphors are very important for me. I mean, like the jukebox is a metaphor. Mm-hmm. When I construct a book, I try to construct it with some large overarching metaphors like that. The lace, the jukebox, the radio that Rocco is using. Rocco is a radio man. Sending and receiving messages that he can't interpret because they're all in code. Life is a code. He doesn't know why he's here. Everything finally is a code. Fingerly, his commanding officer, is a code. He sees the coded messages in the airwaves as a form of lace and a kind of music, so that the metaphors start merging and cooperating with each other. They are lace, music, codes. Melita finally is a code. He wonders, can he ever really understand Melita? So definitely I work with, you know, I mm-hmm. always trying to cut my work back towards plot, and of course your editors are always breathing down your neck about things like that. Correctly so, because most of all, a novel is a story. A novel is a story. But then I think, too, poems are stories. Often that's not perceived to be so, but every poem is containing a story. Mm.
Reviewers have compared the Jukebox Queen of Malta to Joseph Heller's Catch-22 and the films of Fellini. How do you feel about those comparisons?
Very good. I mean, it's
good company to be in.
Yes, it's very nice. Very nice. I think I'm more conscious of the differences, but certainly they both have been influences on me. I wouldn't say I was trying to duplicate any of their stuff in my work, but I think consciously different. I mean, when you look at Catch-22 and Yossarian as against Rocco, they're really very different people. Rocco is involved in a romance, and Yossarian really isn't. Yossarian wants to get away from Malta, get away from the war, and he finally succeeds in doing that. Rocco goes back to the war. He has an opportunity to duck out of it, but he doesn't take it. So the directions of the characters and the motivation are really very different. They are, of course, both in that crazy, surreal atmosphere of world war. I mean, there's no other description for it. It's Joseph Heller came up with a wonderful name for it, Catch-22. Mm-hmm. But that's war. Yes, very nice. I like Fellini's effects very much. I like his fantasy, and I always try to weave some fantasy into my writing. I hope to do more of that in the future.
Mm. Well, I look forward to reading more of your work.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. I'm sorry we have to wrap up our conversation at this point.
I know, it's been a pleasure, Celeste. Very nice being here.
Thank you so much, and I hope we'll talk again.
Okay, fine.
Nicholas Rinaldi has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Look for his book, The Jukebox Queen of Malta, a novel. The book is published by Simon & Schuster.